Hi, I'm Hedgeye's founder, Keith McCullough. Thanks for listening to this Real Conversation. If you like what you hear, you will love our investing research. We bring transparency, accountability, and actionable investing ideas to investors big and small. I'll put our investing process and team up against anyone in the world. Please visit Hedgeye.com to subscribe and learn a better way to invest. I'm Keith McCullough, and welcome back. This is the ninth conversation, so we're in the ninth inning of a three-day run. This is the last one, and no matter, and I think Kyle triggered some of you Canadian friends of mine. Don't do that. If I'm going into the ninth inning and I need a cleanup hitter, I'm going to pick an American, not a Canadian. It's okay. I actually don't even know if there's, well, maybe the my Canadian fans could tell me, Kyle, who the most famous Canadian cleanup hitter is, but I can think of a lot more Americans. So anyway, thank you for having fun on Twitter. More people should do that.
I agree. And thank you, Keith. It's always a pleasure to be with you.
It's great. We were just talking offline, Kyle, and I was like, where should I start? I mean, now you're considered the nice guy or the right guy on China. Ordinarily, I'd start with China. Maybe we should. But also, you know, the energy views that you have, I think, are really important right now. I actually, in thinking of it all together on the fly, I don't think you can unpack the two. So why don't I just let you take your first cut at?
Well, I mean, look, with China, we talked beforehand. Some people like to say, "Oh, you're a China bear," and look, in the end, we're all just realists. And I think, Keith, what you cut through the best is you just give your unvarnished view of where you think things are going, and the world needs more of you, as someone that's not beholden to any one investor or any one advertiser or any one client. You kind of tell it how it is, and I think it's vital to speak truth, because we all know that we live today in a post-truth world. Mm-hmm. Whoever can develop the best narrative and propagate it as widely as they can, it becomes truth over time. And so I think just trying to see things for what they are, and then realizing again what the incentives of all the players are to figure out where you're hearing bullshit and where you're hearing truth is very important. And you know, we talked about that offline, but when you're reading a Bloomberg news story today, you're realizing that Xi Jinping is essentially approving all of those stories, right? They can never say anything critical of Xi because they'll get thrown out of China like they did for the Beaujolais series many years ago. And Bloomberg had to go back to Xi literally on his hands and knees to be allowed back into China. So whether you're watching a Disney film or whether you're reading a Bloomberg news story or whether you're listening to Ray Dalio on TV, you know, all of those views are being bought and surveilled by China. And
that's
so
terrible. I mean, it's terrible. I mean, it's especially for a guy like Dalio. I mean, you know, and I have tremendous respect for, you know, the book that he wrote, Principles, because in principle, you know, in its orientation, that's what you're talking about, truth telling, having a flexible and objective research team that is seeking truth. Whereas in practice, obviously, what you're making the point that that's not the case with Ray, and that's unfortunate. You know, to the extent that that really is obvious to anybody, it sounds like it is to you. You know, what's going to change that? Like, I mean, these are the people that are in the biggest positions of power at the tops of the ivory towers.
Yeah, I mean, look, it's important again to think about the incentive structure of everyone in the private sector, but even at the government level, we all know who has the strongest lobbies, who pays the most into the think tanks to get white papers written, right. how they influence both the private sector and the public sector, and again, we're staying with China. They've infiltrated every crack and crevice in our economy and in our world, and they can actually help develop narratives within the U.S. from U.S. people because of their monetary influence and their both direct and indirect briberies of key personnel in our country. So again, thinking about how we obtain unbiased, unvarnished views is what I'm after the most. And it's truly why I'm so outspoken about it. I'm very passionate about the national security of the West. And, you know, I joked about Canada, you know, whether it's the US, Canada, Mexico, and Europe, yeah, where we have we have rules of law, and we have respect for human rights, and we have a rules-based order where we have somewhat of an alignment throughout the West versus, they call it, axis of evil, whether you're talking about China or Russia or Iran or North Korea or Cuba or Venezuela. You know, we have the axis of evil versus the rules following, rules bearing West. And I believe this battle, as you probably can see, we're coming to a point where, you know, things have been cyber, things have been economic, things have been propaganda slash data driven. It feels like we're getting to a kinetic point to me, right? Mm-hmm. We are seeing more and more incursions into Taiwanese airspace by the Chinese military. And anyway, we're getting to a point in time in which things are going to go even less financial and more kinetic.
Yeah, it's as George Costanza said in Seinfeld, it's not a lie if you believe it. That's it's an interesting thing. I said, what's going to change it? I mean, you're changing it. You know, we like to think we're making our small part every day. God willing, two feet on the floor and two hands on my Twitter board at 4:30 in the morning, Kyle. I'm gonna say what I see. I'm not gonna say what some Chinese dude or American, for that matter, tells me I should see. There's not going to be an asset manager out there. You know, we do businesses. We do business with all types of institutions, and I care about them as clients, but I don't give a shit if I say something that offends somebody if it's truly what we see in the research. So thank you for saying that. That quote, by the way, came from this book called Think Again, which is Adam Grant, youngest tenured professor at a major ivory tower. So it's not like changes haven't been occurring. What is the kinetic, like, what do you mean by that? Like, what is kinetic about it? The Chinese, I could say, for me, kinetically, the Hong Kong crashing this year is great on the short side. That's been kinetic.
right. That's financially kinetic. What I mean by kinetic is, right, you know, when the economics, the cyber domain, and the propaganda war all turn into something that's physical. And yeah, I'm talking about the flights that are getting closer and closer to Taiwan, and the ones that are entering Taiwan's air defense zone, and China's adding more and more planes. They're adding nuclear bombers. They're adding fighter jets in each incursion. At some point in time, there's going to be a real problem there. And I believe that time is coming. I think China wants to legitimize itself by hosting the Beijing Olympics next year. It'll be maybe the first time that we have a country that the U.S. State Department, both under Pompeo and Secretary Blinken, have labeled as a regime committing crimes against humanity and genocide, where we actually oblige them and maybe show up with our Olympic team. I actually think it's at risk, but I think China wants to have the Olympics. They want to roll out their central bank digital currency to dramatically lessen their dependence upon our dollars feeding their communist tumor of growth. And I think once they do that, so when we get exactly a year from today, I think all bets are off on the kinetic side. And I think market participants need to be thinking about that long and hard.
Well, it's interesting, like, because mostly everything you've talked about over the years, you've made the case that they're structural, they're irreparable in terms of damages. But it takes an economic slowdown, like, at least having back-tested every single country that we, all 50 countries that we look at, you really do need a nasty quad four deflation, and or in China's case, which could be worse, which is a quad three stagflation, really to agitate and challenge the institution, because the people do. People don't like that economic scenario. And that's what we have. Do you agree with that? Do you think that the recent slowdown, which has been fairly dramatic, actually, even in the numbers that the Chinese themselves make up, if you were making up numbers, like, if you're Chinese making up these numbers, you should have made up better numbers, and they didn't.
Yeah. I mean, look, you're right. The quad three stagflation is infinitely worse than quad four deflation for an environment like China, where you don't grow or make enough of your own food, right? You're short food, yeah. You're massively short energy, you're short basic materials, and truthfully, you're short dollars. You need the dollar pipeline to keep coming in, because that's how you settle all of your global transactions. So if what you're having there is food prices are up, what, 50% now in the last 8 or 9 months, if you look at the UN Ag Food World Index, a quad three stagflation, where you have massive negative real rates. You have prices that are way out of reach for the, call it, billion plus Chinese that are poor, and even the 400 million that have moved in, out of abject poverty into some kind of Chinese middle class. You're going to have another Arab Spring. I mean, we know what drove the Arab Spring, and look at what's happening now. You have LNG cargoes being contracted in Asia at $35 an M, all-time highs. Mm-hmm. Even post Fukushima, when Japan was really struggling to secure its LNG cargoes along with competing with China, those numbers got to like $22 an M. We're at $35 an M. Right, gas prices in Europe are up 60% in 3 days. Like, their world is massively short energy, and we've just printed more money than we've ever printed in world history, and we've underinvested in hydrocarbon production for the last 7 years. This is perfectly set up for a quad three stagflation that's really going to hurt.
Yeah, people don't. I mean, they do. I guess they can appreciate your. The narrative now that it's backstopped by stagflation numbers in China is, like I said at the outset, I mean, now all of a sudden Kyle Bass is the good guy for just being, you know, the truth teller. I mean, okay, that's one thing. But they don't really get into the weeds on things that we would readily pull up on our Bloomberg. The Bloomberg machine is still valuable if you just keep it to the time series and not the narratives, by the way. Slide 72, for example, those shipping rates from Shanghai to Europe, or, you know, otherwise for that matter. I mean, these things are wacky. I mean, these are crazy things. And I guess my question is, like, when you wrap that cyclical reality or the thing that's on people's screens today around the longer-term demographic and communist threat, slide 96, guys, this, even the IMF has this working paper now, Kyle, on this Lewis turning point. Isn't the IMF in bed with the Chinese? Like, how can they say these things?
Yeah, I mean, you know, every supranational institution, from the IMF to the World Bank to the African Development Bank, have all been completely infiltrated, and the narratives have all been crafted by the Chinese. So I literally pay no attention to what they say.
Well, that Lewis turning point is actually one of the few that isn't what you said. That's the one that says, okay, by the year 2020, you know, between now and 2025, the single child policy, you know, the demographic curve's collapsing, they're going to come home to roost. You're going to have less people to do the things that you were doing, and you'll be able to oppress less and less people because they're going to get pissed off. I mean, that's kind of the...
Yeah.
For the IMF to have a working paper on that, I was like, wow, that's pretty good. That's like the Dallas Fed's paper on U.S. rents. I'm like, wow, actually, they actually have some real data. This is nice.
Yeah, they actually wrote something real. Yeah, this Lewis turning point, I mean, you don't really have to be a PhD, have right. a PhD in demography to see that the birth rate in China for the average female is now 1.2. It takes a 2.1 to 2.2 net birth rate to maintain a population. So they are way below the maintenance. They're actually in a population decline. And what's important to realize is there's a 20-year duration mismatch between any kind of stimulative effects the government can engage in for people to have children and for those children to become productive workers.
Yeah.
So there's a really big hole in the central planning matrix, and they've missed it. And the compounding factor, and this is why you see Xi Jinping bringing this crackdown, this controlled detonation of the Chinese property sector, which is beginning with Evergrande, and it will end with many more. By the way, this isn't the only company that he's targeting. There are many of them that he's going to go after. What's happened is property prices, given the activity and the largesse of the central bank, the PBOC, the Fed, the rest of them, but in this case, the PBOC, they have meteoric real estate prices in tier one cities, tier two, tier three, and even tier four cities saw meteoric moves in China. And what's happening is the middle class, these men that are supposed to be marrying women and procreating, can't afford to buy a house.
Yep.
So they're living in their parents' basements, and they're not marrying women. They're living online, and they're not having kids. And China is in a spiral, and Xi's just figured this out. So he is literally detonating the property sector because he has to get property prices down. Now, trying to hold a beach ball underwater when it's fully inflated is tough. And what I mean by that is the amount of money that they've put into the system, along with the U.S. and others, is going to be very tough to get prices to sustainably stay lower given the amount of liquidity, the amount of money in the system. So this is how you get stagflation.
It's an amazing thing. Like we can go on the rail of ESG here in the U.S. or in Europe for that matter. Like the unintended consequences of these brilliant government policies, whether they be communist, socialist, or allegedly capitalistic. It's amazing. I mean, guys, just to augment what Kyle just said, Neil Howe's work, which you're well aware of, slide 99 on birth rates, just to show what Kyle's saying there with our projection on that collapsing, China's working age population, slide 100, and then China's working age population for the next, 20, 30 years, which is on slide 101. I mean, these are devastating. I mean, he knew about those, Kyle, right? He didn't know that how it would all go together, I guess, is like fractally. I mean, not going right. It just went all nonlinear on the guy.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and, when you grow your credit system, think about this. They grew their credit system 50%, 50% of GDP every year for 6 years in a row. Imagine if the U.S. grew credit $11 trillion a year for 6 years. You imagine where we would be. Yeah, would we have meteoric growth? Yes. Would we have prices that are sky high everywhere? Yes. We have negative real rates of return? Absolutely. But nominally, we'd be growing the living shit out of our economy, right? But we'd also know that all of those assets in our banking system are bunk, and they're in real trouble. And that's where China is today, right? They have to get property prices to turn around. They've got a real population birth rate problem, and they've got a supercharged credit system that's going to have a comeuppance. Now, I actually believe that the Chinese government has 25 plates spinning at once, and I think internally they might be able to keep the plates spinning. Externally, the plates are falling all over the place, and that's because the narrative around their actions is so obvious. Even recently, with the hostage diplomacy they engaged in with two amazing Canadians and one alleged Chinese criminal being in Canada. So I think that what they just did there is they just showed the world exactly who they are, and I think that's really going to work against them.
Yeah, there's the big asset manager who can't get out. There's that line. Then there are the small, not even asset managers, but many American capitalists tried it and have since left, and if they haven't, I don't know what they're doing. You may not find them. But you also have this external versus internal debate. We have this debate internally all the time. I'm Diego Paria said that it's Lehman squared in one of the first conversations I had at this summit. Whereas internally we're like, well, it's good for some of my analysts will say, well, it's good for these domestic manufacturers because we're going to bring it home. It's good for this. It's good for that. It's not. I can't get myself to say it's just bad for everything or it's just good for everything externally or internally. I could say it internally. China. I'm short China outright. No hedge. But I can't. I don't know where I'm at on how this is going to affect the U.S. Most importantly, what I care about, which are markets.
Yeah, I mean, look, our own view internally is that if we were to completely decouple with China, we think it would have a negative effect on U.S. GDP by 1 point.
Okay.
Okay. That's our view, and there's a lot of work behind that. I think that if you're taking a third of China's GDP growth, which is their property sector and all the concentric circles around it, and you're taking that to a negative number, that's how Goldman got to a 0% growth rate for China for the next year, right? So if China's contribution to global GDP is going to be zero, plus or minus a couple of tenths of a point, well, that means it's just generally slightly negative for the world, right? Yeah. So my takeaway on the external factor here is China's definitely going to have a little bit of a resurgence lower, and I think that that's going to, slow down global GDP a bit.
Just bringing this back to what I wanted to get to anyway, which is shortages as far as the eye can see. That's very poorly understood and certainly not capitalized on. You don't see a lot of people that really made enough money as they should have, being long commodities, for example, or those that can take that pricing on the top line. What do you think it looks like from a labor shortage perspective? I mean, our internal work, you know, 5 million people died in the world to COVID. Bullshit. I mean, China saying they have X amount of people who have COVID currently. Bullshit. You know, the amount of people that died doing things in China at sweatshop rates is a number nobody will ever know. But that's a labor base that is not coming back, and we may have to rebuild it here.
Yeah. Look, we should. I mean, we've had enough time. Corporations in the U.S. and Canada and the rest of Europe have had enough time to realize that their supply chains being anchored in China is a bad idea. Having their own citizens living in China is no longer safe. We all know these things now. But we don't want to go down the virus wormhole because we've been doing some work here that people might deem to be xenophobic, but we can maybe talk about it later. I think when we get to the shortages of things out there, energy is key.
Yep.
And I am very much an environmentalist at heart. I launched a private equity firm this year that focuses on mitigating environmental impacts. It's a niche business that I love. And so coming from an environmentalist, what I'm trying to tell you is the virtue signaling of going from hydrocarbon-based fuel to alternative methods, whether it be wind, solar, et al., cannot be achieved in a few short years. The galaxy brains that are running things think we can just flip the switch, throw up some more windmills, some more solar, find some more places to put hydro up, and we'll just switch. It takes 40 to 50 years for new fuels to take over at least 30% of the global fuel world when you look back to how coal entered the world, how natural gas entered the world. These things take multiple decades. And so what we effectively did 7 years ago is we said, you know, less fracking, and now it's no drilling on federal lands, and now it's no more interstate pipelines. We just decided we're just going to turn off hydrocarbons. And what those people don't understand is hydrocarbon demand is inelastic. The world continues to grow due to the largesse of a lot of these central banks flooding the world with liquidity and growth. And now the world's about to reopen from COVID. And when it reopens, global demand for crude is going to blast right through, we think, 105, 106 million barrels a day. And the crude complex can't possibly pump that much. So the same phenomenon that took the front end of the curve negative when there was just a glut with nowhere to put it, there's going to be a demand out there that can't be satiated by physical supply. So the front end is going to go crazy again. Mm-hmm. We are certain to see $100 crude in the near future. And those options have been trading in DEES 22 for $200. Now, I'm not buying those options, but they are trading, just to let you know. So I think other people are seeing what I'm talking about here. And let me give you some insight.
Did you say the December 2022 contracts at $200 WTI?
Yeah. 1,800 of them traded just a couple days ago.
You didn't put that on the tape just so you could say that, did you?
I did. I did. No. I put it on the Twitter tape. I did not. I was not the buyer of that tape.
I'm kidding.
No. But I do think that some inside baseball is a lot of the public money, so the mutual fund money, stopped buying energy stocks because of ESG, either mandate or discussions, six, seven years ago. And then you had, but you still had big private equity, and you had investors that were global pension funds and endowments, you know, big institutional investors were still plowing money into the private sector of energy venture capital and energy private equity for development. And if you aggregate some of the, if you aggregate wholly owned companies at some of these private private VCs and energy private equity firms have, they rival Exxon. Quantum Energy down in Houston, if you add all of their drilling rigs together of all the companies they wholly own, they're the second largest driller in North America. Wow. And you probably never heard of them before.
No.
The point being is that was a huge engine for maintaining our production levels in America, maybe growing them a little bit. And then now what you've seen just recently, even though pricing now natural gas has gone from 2 to 6 in the U.S., oil has gone from what, 35, 40 to 80. And you should see more rigs popping up, more companies drilling, and you should see money in being invested into the sector. And in fact, they're treating it like the plague. Some of those big institutional investors that have never wavered because they've made so much money with these private equity firms are now in the new private equity firms' funds. They're disappearing. The top five investors are saying we can no longer do this. So it's counterintuitive. At this moment in time, the ROEs on these projects are so enormous, but there's very little money in the space. And in fact, it's running the other way right now, again, because we have virtue signaling and ESG mandates where these boards of even the big pension funds and the big endowments are just saying, sorry, our board's saying no more hydrocarbons. We need to do more wind and solar. Well, that is setting the market up for a crazy shortage of hydrocarbons this winter. So I think this winter is going to be very difficult. And as you know, natural gas tripling makes the cost of fertilizer almost triple, which makes the cost of food skyrocket even more. So you're about to see food prices continue to rip, and you're going to see wages move, and you're have shortages of truck drivers and shortages of this and that because people don't want to work anymore. You're going to have to incentivize them to work, which means you're going to have to pay them a lot more. So I think you're going to see a Q3 stagflation on steroids in the next 6 months.
Yeah, the tip of the spear is oil on the input cost side, big time. And we just walked through that with Josh Crum. But so if you go and you say, look, I care about the environment, but over here you see this massive gapping CapEx hole on hydrocarbons, like, and then you say the people that could fund, you know, the gap closing or fund CapEx or fund equity, whatever they want to do, private equity, back in the higher, you're just saying that's just your point is that is shot, gone for dead, that's not coming back, and therefore inflation.
Yeah, I mean, I think that the titration of capital, maybe even the cessation of capital in call it major forms going into hydrocarbons is, I think it's a fait accompli, but I think that I think you have an environment where the good news here is because you have so much, the price of hydrocarbons is so much higher, many of the other alternative energy ideas become more competitive again as price goes higher, right?
Yeah.
But I think you're going to see the front end come unhinged. I think the curve will move higher, but the front end will really be in trouble at some point this winter for both gas and oil.
Well, who's going to be in real trouble if that happens is a certain party at the midterms. So you have, I mean, again, I even heard some, again, I kind of like, I'm a grazer when it comes to CNBC sound bites. I either get in the car, I'm getting, picking my kid up at hockey, I flip it between the highway country to, you know, to this and, you know, try to get live quotes on an Asian market open, basically. And then I hear somebody just say something like, oh, the consumer can handle $100 oil. It's not like it used to be. It's like, who the fuck did you grow up with? Like, first of all, like, I mean, I don't care where you grew up, in Texas or in Canada with me. I mean, that is a major problem. 100, 150. I don't need to go to $200 oil.
It's such a regressive tax on the poor. Think about who this affects the most, right? The reason, so this is kind of internal politics, but the reason people are moving from high tax, high cost jurisdictions like the West Coast, like San Francisco and LA, to Texas and the new Northeast, again, high tax, high cost jurisdictions. What's making Texas, Tennessee, and Florida grow so much is, as a middle class family, you can actually move here, you can have an affordable house, you can have great schools, and you can actually make your life work. You can no longer make your life work in these other jurisdictions. And by the way, if the cost of your food and your gasoline is going to double or triple, you're out of business as a poor middle class person. So I think the administration that's playing with the energy markets here and really strongly virtue signaling, and you have those progressive crazy people talking about the Green New Deal. I mean, they have no idea what they're wishing for. If they get what they wish for, they are going to be massacred.
I tell you what's green, what the greenies got on this. I cited this throughout different discussions on slide 42. This is this real-time rental tracker by major MSA. And I spent too much time calling out Tampa, which clearly is up 29.5%. These are August numbers. They're higher in September. These are year-over-year rents. So to your point, and to the point of this slide, what you should have noticed is that people aren't going to Berkeley, California, Los Angeles, or demanding, you know, apartments in San Francisco. Those are the numbers are flat to red or down. It's to Kyle's point, you know, whether it's Texas or it's Tennessee, you know, these numbers in Memphis are up 17. Florida. Yeah, Florida's the biggest numbers. But, I mean, you can only do that so much. So let's just get back to America, like the America that I came to, or the one that you were born in and grew up in. Like I came in the 90s, you know, when you had a strong dollar, strong America, you had a relatively low cost of living and real growth was high, right? That's 1993 to 1999, big time. It's actually, if you want it, if you think it's political, and it was Clinton, and same thing, 1983 to 89 under Reagan, strong dollar, relatively low cost of living. You know, that's not what we're talking about. We're talking about the key cost centers for people that grew up like I did on a firefighter's budget, being the roof over your head, whether you have a mortgage on it or you're renting on it, the food on the table, and the gas in the car. I mean, it's and now medical's a lot higher too. So, like, how is that not an ongoing, and inflation not an ongoing political, you know, football that is going to be increasingly hard to swallow?
Yeah, it is. And look, if you, again, if you look at some of these high tax, mismanaged, high cost jurisdictions, they all have the same. They all have the same polarization, right? They have very rich. They have the very rich that can afford it, and then they have the horribly poor, and the middle class have to leave, and the horribly poor live on the streets, and they just kind of, you know, in a district like Pelosi, she just they can't deal with homelessness. They have the rich elite live in Pacific Heights, and they can afford everything. They spend a lot of money on education. But that education money per capita goes to the pensions and the teachers unions. So you have organized labor. Like, you can sketch out where the problem areas are in our country, wherever there's organized labor, where there are high barriers to firing tenured teachers in the school system, where there are very high cost of real estate, and then the poor. So I believe you can have a lot of migration over time to very pro-business, low to no tax jurisdictions that are focused on staying open. And again, I sound like I'm partisan, but like these are logical things. And so I think the U.S. is going to see that. And I think this is a secular trend, Keith. It's going to happen for decades to come.
Well, I mean, the solution to any longer term or secular trend is going to be the next innovation at the Federal Reserve, and or the combination or the weaponization of that with the Treasury. Any thoughts on how this plays out? Because obviously, if you use our scenario, whether it be China slowing and the U.S. Doing that precisely from a trending inflation perspective, you're going to need to find a way to fill those gaps. You're going to need, like Janet Yellen is a raging, like, you know, socialist when it comes to living wage. You can go down the line on all the different things that people are going to need in this type of an inflating environment.
Yeah. Well, look, if UBI is where we're headed, and you know, COVID gave us the opportunity to begin a UBI experiment. I think you and I both know how that's going to end. Paying people to stay home, they're going to stay at home. They're not going to work. I can give you anecdote after anecdote in my family and people that I support and people that my friends support. I see what UBI does to people, and it's not positive. This living wage, this problem with homelessness, you know, my wife writes for The Economist, and she interviewed a very famous governor of a very famous state who I will leave out. And at the end of the interview, he said, you know, off the record, and she said that off the record's fine. He said, you know what one word I never said publicly in my entire governorship? And she said, no, what is it? And he said, homelessness, because there isn't an answer. So, you know, there are problems that are unsolvable. There are problems that should be addressed with mental health issues or mental health authorities. And you're going to have to fund some of those problems, but you're going to have to deconstruct some of these edifices that have been put up to, again, have so much money go to pensions and retirements and the high wages. And for those people that are tenured and unfireable, you're going to have to reallocate some of those resources to make it work. And mm-hmm. Janet Yellen is going to be an advocate of expanding the Fed's balance sheet and having the Treasury help expand the Fed's balance sheet as fast as it can, to the extent that these holes, you know, really start gapping and showing themselves. So my view is we're going to keep expanding the central bank's balance sheet. We're never going to taper off of this, quote, emergency funding. Just think about this. We just spent $5.5 trillion in the last year, and they already want to spend another $3.5 trillion.
It's ridiculous.
It's absolute insanity. But, you know, when was the last time you heard the words Tea Party? Even the Republicans believe now that debt doesn't matter and that the central bank can solve all their problems. So we're going for broke now on both sides.
Well, on the one side, you know, like our Washington office, I don't know if you know JT Taylor or not, who runs it, but he keeps commenting on how much Democrats are splitting from each other, because some people are like, well, I know we're left to center, but we're not like over there. It's just like I don't want to go off on that anymore.
If you sit with Joe Manchin, and I recently had the opportunity to just have lunch with him and a handful of friends, and I left. I came into that lunch being pretty despondent about the political polarization of our world and the fact that, along partisan lines, if votes happen along partisan lines, we can see that $3.5 trillion is coming at us like a freight train. Mm-hmm. And in that lunch with Joe Manchin, he said, I will never bend on the $3.5 trillion. He said, we have no idea what the $5.5 trillion is going to do to our economy in the long term. We are no longer in a quote emergency situation. We need to calm down and we need to really think about how to spend that money on infrastructure. Real infrastructure, not this quote human infrastructure pass-throughs that don't work. So I came out of that lunch having hope that our democracy was going to be intact, because God forbid somebody doesn't vote with the party and votes his own conscience. And it was a wonderful day. And all of my friends that attended that lunch said the same thing. So I don't want to put all my hopes on one person, but hearing someone really be lucid and explain in depth their own feelings and thoughts and how they felt about this, the craziness, led me to believe that we were going to be okay.
That is interesting. Wow. Thanks for sharing that. I would not have known that. All right. If you don't mind, I got like 8 minutes to rattle off some of these top questions. The top voted question is from Avery. Kyle, the last time you were on Hedgeye, you talked about a growing U.S. dollar shortage in China. Is that one of the causes for the turmoil we're seeing in China, or just a symptom of something larger?
So China solved that dollar shortage over time by putting in, right, there are active lines, and the way that the analogy I like to draw is how bloodlines are needed to grow tumors. Mm-hmm. And so when you think about the Chinese Communist Party tumor that's growing in this world, the bloodline has to be dollars. It could be dollars, euros, yen, or pounds, but, you know, call it 85 to 87% of global cross-border settles in dollars. So they put in passive dollar flows, right? They convinced the Bloomberg old Barclays bond aggregate index to add them and give them a representative weighting, hundreds of billions of dollars of passive money flowing into China. They convinced MSCI and Henry Hernandez to add them and make them major index constituents in MSCI Asia, MSCI China, this and that. And so they've just put in passive bloodlines that keep the blood flowing to the tumor. And I think that those may come into question given the belligerence of the Chinese Communist Party and their militaristic ambitions, right? How they're handling the South China Sea. More importantly, what are their true ambitions with Taiwan? If you've read any of the books like Unrestricted Warfare or any of the books that have been translated into English, Taiwan is part of the First Island Chain. Their goal was to secure the first island chain by 2020, and it's 2 years, year and a half later. So if they move on Taiwan, those bloodlines could be severed. And I think, again, there's this schism in the world today between the State Department, the Defense Department, the rules-based order in the West, and Wall Street, right? 12% of Wall Street's revenue today comes from China. Chinese IPOs, Chinese M&A. And so you will never, ever see a Wall Street firm decide that it's a good idea to stop the blood flow to China or to sanction Chinese banks, even if they're bad actors, or to think about U.S. national security. You know, I've said before, if U.S. national security is left up to Wall Street, we'll all be speaking Chinese tomorrow. So it's important to think about how that capital flows, and it's now a passive flow. The question is, will the active flows reverse? And, you know, I was disheartened recently when BlackRock's own chief investment strategist, who is Chinese, Wei Li, said, in the midst of the Evergrande disaster, the clampdown on the education stocks and the tech sector in China, with China imploding, she said, China's no longer an emerging economy. It's a developed economy. It's time to triple your Chinese investments. Well, if you look at the Shanghai Composite over the last 10 years, Keith, I know you have this chart somewhere. It's annualized at an annual 3.4% increase, while the S&P, where we have a rule of law, we have we respect human rights, and we've compounded at an annual 14.5%. And Wei Li at BlackRock is telling us that you're being compensated for the additional Xi Jinping risks and the fact that Chinese companies aren't really audited risk by investing in China, when that's just a bold-faced lie. Look at the look at the numbers, and you can see that the better investment is in the West and not in the East. People just have FOMO with China.
Yeah, I mean, it's like, or it's Costanza. It's not a lie if you believe it, man. This is nuts. I mean, 12% of Wall Street. That's crazy. Our institutional business is up, I'm not going to say what double digits, but partly because we shorted China. You know, it's just like you get people out of China before Bill Huang blew up in China. It's like, you know, there's another side to that, too, right? That's, I like to think we're Wall Street 2.0, but I mean, that's a huge number, Kyle. And thank God you've done like all the work. Here's another good question. Kyle, I really enjoy all your interviews, especially on Real Vision and HedgeEye, where they let you speak. can I get your thoughts on the U.S. real estate market? Is there going to be a bubble there?
Yeah, so I actually don't believe so. I don't think we have the same, we don't have the same leverage in our markets that we had going into 2008. I do think that the amount of money that we have in our system, the amount of cash on the sidelines, so it's really important to realize that my answer is predicated on something that I'm not even sure Keith believes. My view is that we're going to have double digit real inflation, but I don't think 10-year rates are going to move over 2%, right? I think we're going to be printing negative real rates for the next decade. In that environment, I think real estate prices will continue to move higher, right? There'll be idiosyncrasies where maybe, you know, in the rough neighborhoods of Chicago, that real estate will never come back. But generally across the country, and especially in the areas where there are population migrations, you're going to see nothing but higher and higher and higher prices over time.
We have the same view. And to be clear, some people will get lost in my current view and what that view would be. And this is further down the line. It's another career away from me, which is like next year, which is what Josh Crumb spoke about, which is the structural nature to this underlying inflation. And if you get a 1970s style quad three stagflation, you want to be long hard assets. And you want, you know, 10-year yield is going to be going down. Actually, it's not going to be going up. That's because real growth is going down and real rates are going down. I think everybody knows what that means. Here's a good question.
That's where we're headed.
Here's another good. This is a good question. If you answer yes to this, I want to definitely spend some time on this. from Eddie, did you ever have a private debate with Ray Dalio about China?
I have not had a private debate with Ray Dalio on China. I've had private conversations with Bridgewater leadership on that subject and others. I've spent a lot of time talking about it. But it's of my opinion that, and it is kind of known in the institutional investment world secondhand, that the Chinese government is one of Bridgewater's largest investors.
Yep.
In the multiples of billions. And so if you're charging a 2% fee on $6 billion, the Chinese government's paying you $120 million just to turn the lights on that year. And so it's really difficult to get a straight answer out of someone that is so deeply intertwined with, look, at one point in time, we're going to stop calling China a strategic competitor and we're going to start calling them what they are. They're the enemy. They're the enemy to the West. They're the enemy to our way of life, to our democracy. We've seen how they can snuff out democracy and human rights. They did it in Hong Kong. And so it's difficult to have this conversation with someone that has a China office, that is allowed into PBOC meetings, that knows Chinese leadership and has China's Inc. as one of their biggest investors. How can you get a straight answer out of someone like that? So it's kind of a losing battle. You're never going to get truth out of them.
Well, I mean, somebody who has principles, you know, I think that at a bare minimum, what you just did was challenged him on something that can be replayed and forwarded many times over. I challenge you, Ray Dalio. I think you've been challenged this year. Why don't you step up and have a real conversation with Kyle Bass? I'll just sit in between the two of you, and I won't say anything at all. I mean, this is America. Why can't we have these conversations?
Agreed. Like, give a straight answer. How much money has the Chinese government ever invested with you? How much do they have invested with you now? And how do you think personally about the squashing of human rights, about the ethnic and cultural genocide that's being committed against not only the Uyghurs, not only the Falun Gong, not only the Mongolians, not all of them, that whether you're a Christian, a Jew, a Muslim, they are eradicating religion throughout China because Xi is the religion. We're going back to the Mao days. And he's the greatest genocidal killer in world's history of his own people. He takes Hitler and Stalin to task. So why on earth are we funding the enemy? Why on earth are we getting in bed with the enemy? Is it only for money? Because if it is, that's a really ugly answer.
Well, it's got to be part of the answer. And it needs to, I do think, again, like, why can't this debate happen? Like, why can't Kyle Bass say what he just said and have somebody respond? I mean, there must be a response. There has to be a response. I didn't write a book called Principles. You did, Ray. Like, what are your principles on that? Because really, this is a little bit more. It's tangentially. It's akin to the Federal Reserve. Well, the rules didn't say they couldn't, and the rules didn't say Ray couldn't. But in principle, like. In moral compass terms, or like in American terms, what say you about that?
I've only seen a journalist press him on it once, and I think it was Andrew Ross Sorkin pressed him and said, you know, people say China's invested with you and you manage money for the Chinese government. Do you do it? And I urge you to go watch this CNBC interview. Ray, he stutters a few times and he says, well, I mean, that's crazy. I manage money for lots of governments. I manage money for the U.S. government. He deflected the question. He didn't answer it. And it's almost like, as an analyst on Wall Street, if you're talking about a company, you have to sign the analyst disclosure. I, my family, my company, we either do have investments in this company or we don't. We're being objective or we're not. And in this case, everyone gives him a pass because he's a billionaire. And giving billionaires passes.
It's not just because he's a billionaire. I don't think that's what you're implying. It's because it's access. It's access to Ray Dalio. CNBC runs a melting ice cube of an audience that we take every day. Not just me. I mean, you, I, on Twitter, lots of people out there. This isn't about Hedjai. It's not about Kyle Bass. It's that when you are under that, and that's the financial incentive too, Kyle, which is, again, if it's not, then why are you doing it? Why are you being a non-investigative journalist with no questions that aren't just patting the guy or laying up softballs? It's because you run a melting ice cube of eyeballs, and to get incremental eyeballs or maintain the ice cube, you need to bring on Federal Reserve guys that are day trading. You need to bring on guys with huge conflicts of interest that have big names. I mean, that's it.
That is a cynical view, but I don't know if their viewership's actually declining. I didn't know that was the case, but if you do, look, I think they do the public a good. I think they need to be more honest in their reporting, and they need to be ask the tough questions, right?
More ask honest. Like it's questions. Not even it doesn't even start with like now that I'm really going to just let out the laundry. Like when I would go too far on both CNBC and Fox. So it's not like it's not a Republican Democrat thing. And I don't know if you've been told this or not. You know, I was explicitly told to rein it in, or I wouldn't even be able, with Trump on Fox, I wasn't even allowed to be on a live mic when he was talking. Like, it was like, you're not, and I'm not a journalist, right? I'm just a frickin' Canadian who showed up in this country who's got a spine. I don't know what right. it is, but, right. but we don't have that, Kyle. We're having this conversation, but broadly, MSM, the last thing they want to do is lose access to these people because that's how they get paid.
Yeah, that's a good point. But they, at some point in time, they just need to be more honest in their reporting and realize that if they lose access, it's no big deal. But you know what? He'll come back at some point in time because he wants that access himself.
Well, I hope, and if it was me that was being challenged, like you just challenged Ray Dalio and I supported the challenge because I want to see that conversation. I think any man with a principled man who in principle has outlined in a book what his principles are, which is the seeking of truth. I challenge that. I mean, that's a nice way to end. If you have any parting comments on that, that might
yeah.
be.
I would echo your comments. But in today's day and age, I would say any man or woman.
I mean, any man or woman. I mean, Ray's a man. So, I mean, so that's what, you know, we're going with Ray. And Ray, man, I love you, man. Like, I love you, man. As long as I say that at the end, it's good. You know, my house is like a golf shot away from your beautiful compound that you guys built. You know, I'm all for it. Let's have a truth event here. That'd be great. Well, thanks for winding up mine with a little fireworks as you would, Kyle Bass. You know, it's great, and it's nice to see, you know, somebody stick to their guns in this country and be right. Unfortunately, for some of the right reasons on this big topic that everyone cares so much about. So thanks again.
I appreciate it. Come see us down in Texas.
I will. That's where Kyle Bass, by the way, if you ever go to his office, and he's had it there all the time. He's got this big United States dollar, it's like framed thing that I can't give you any more information on that. But ping him. Maybe he'll take a picture of it and tweet about it, because that's what we're all about here at Hedgeye Nation, being transparent, accountable, and trustworthy. Again, that's not just a book that I never wrote. It's what we do every day. Thanks for joining us.
Thanks for listening to Real Conversations, brought to you by Hedgeye. Don't forget to check out Hedgeye.com to get more actionable investing insights from our team of more than 40 research analysts. And check us out on Twitter at our handle, @Hedgeye. This presentation is informational only. None of the information contained herein constitutes an offer to sell or a solicitation of an offer to buy any security or investment vehicle, nor does it constitute investment recommendation or legal, tax, accounting, or investment advice by Hedgeye or any of its employees, officers, agents, or guests. This information is presented without regard for individual investment preferences or risk parameters and is general, non-tailored, non-specific information. This content is based on information from sources believed to be reliable. Hedgeye is not responsible for errors, inaccuracies, or omissions of information. The opinions and conclusions contained in this report are those of the individual expressing those opinions and conclusions and are intended solely for the use of Hedgeye subscribers and the authorized recipients of the content. All investments entail a certain degree of risk, and financial instrument prices can fluctuate based on several factors, including those not considered in the preparation of the content. Consult your financial professional before investing. The information contained herein is protected by United States and foreign copyright laws and is intended solely for the use of its authorized recipient. Access must be provided directly by Hedgeye. Redistribution or republication is strictly prohibited. For more detail, please refer to the terms of service at hedgeye.com/terms of service.